Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and people from all backgrounds, I sincerely welcome you to season 3 of the Journey Onward podcast.
It's already funny, it hasn't even started.
Don't
need to come up with any content, just post an hour of us laughing.
And if you haven't yet had the chance to check out the trailer to season 3, I have full faith you will after this episode. But as a brief overview, the theme of this season is Third Culture Conversations, where I get to speak to great people on their passions, expertise, and perspectives on popular topics through the lens of being third culture kids, or as the cool kids call it now, TCKs.
But no, let's get to business. So, Mr. Vikram Judge, welcome to the Journey Onwards. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me. Yeah, cheers. I appreciate it.
As third culture individuals, all of my guests share the commonality of having grown up in a country that presents a different culture to the one of either one or both of their parents. And what I'm looking to do is explore how my guests' upbringing and family backstory has influenced their identity and values, as well as the fun and embarrassing, but also life-defining stories that has made them who they are today. So to kick off the season, I get the fortune of speaking with my esteemed guest and a very good friend of mine, Mr. Vikram Judge. And he gives some incredible perspectives on his life as well as the world around us. And without further ado, I introduce to you episode 1 with Vic Judge.
How are you doing, homeboy?
Yeah, good. Yeah, fine. What can I say? Saturday.
It's a lovely day. Yeah. You shouldn't have said Saturday because podcasts are meant to be evergreen. And actually, that's fine because Saturday will come every week. That's the first deep insight.
I mean, every day's a Saturday if you have the right mindset.
That's a different analogy, but we'll go with it. Yeah. Just to give a bit more context, like the reason I say what's up, homeboy, is because you really are one of my homeboys. We've obviously known each other very well for a while. And I don't know if you know this, but you are, in fact, piloting season 3.
Oh, I'm the first one.
You are. And so, I mean, there will be an introduction episode anyways, where people get a bit more context on what is season 3 and how the podcast has evolved. But essentially, I've shifted gears to really focus on investigating this idea of being the kids of immigrants and everything that that means, from mindset, character, home life, all the funs and all the ups and all the downs. So no pressure, but you are setting the benchmark for what is going to be a thrilling season.
Oh, that's great. I'm happy to be the first on the pilot. Hopefully the pilot gets approved and then...
Oh, for sure. No doubt. I mean, so that's enough for me. I think I've rambled on long enough, but I really want to hand it over to you. And if you can, just start way back when. So from the beginning, I would just love to hear more about your childhood and growing up.
Okay. My childhood growing up. So I'm the child of two immigrants. Not obvious to most people listening, but yeah, my dad is a South African. He will always say he's South African. He will never say he's Indian. I think he was born in, I don't know, Lanasia, somewhere like that. But yeah, he's the first son of his generation. I think his dad had 7 or 8 brothers and sisters, and his dad was the oldest. And I never met him, but he passed away before I died, is my grandfather. But yeah, dad is a South African, but North Indian immigrants who moved there with his dad.
Do you know how or why they ended up there?
Yeah, I know that. So I've done some traveling around and I went to South Africa and like spoke to people because I was very keen on my grandfather because I never met him. So I wanted to figure out more about that. And I don't know if your dad's like this, but sometimes older men don't talk a lot about their past. And so he wouldn't say too much to me. So you just go and find out yourself. And so my great-grandfather, I think was the first person to move from India to South Africa.
First person ever.
In that family. Yeah. He was the first.
There's papers about him. The first ever man.
He founded South Africa, essentially. And you know when they have those, we found this, the first evidence of a human being in a cave. Yeah. He was the guy in the cave, basically. He moved, I think they they were from somewhere in North India near Chandigarh, and there was an opportunity to go and work basically in South Africa. And he came from people who were kind of businessmen, like traders or whatever. And like my dad's always going on about how his grandfather, so my great grandfather, had like was one of the few like Indian people who had a hotel business in South Africa. And so, you know, I've got these old black and white pictures of this like big hotel. And back then, like, it was very odd for Punjabis to be in South Africa. There's a lot, you'll go to South Africa now, especially on the coast, and there's a lot of South Indians. So he moved there. Then my grandfather worked in the business they had, and then the business got taken away from them. My dad, you know, grew up during apartheid. So he moved eventually to London, well, to South London.
Just before you go into that, so yeah. Growing up, this is quite fascinating. So growing up during the time of apartheid, do you notice anything in your dad around how that really, do you feel like he's developed a really thick skin from that? Do you notice any of that where?
Yeah, I know him to be a very like courageous, no one can tell me what to do, like, you know, you can't stop me to do things kind of person. Like, he'll always stand up for what he thinks is right. And yeah, I mean, like, he's to some extent, he's very aware of different people, different cultures, speaks lots of languages, things like that. But also is like, there is some trauma or this chip on his shoulder, or this thing that he has being, you know, he will say, like, you know, I remember he lived in California, and they were trying to build a road through his neighborhood for the fire trucks. And it was like the second route. It wasn't the primary route. And he lived in this kind of, you know, cul-de-sac of houses. If you like, all the residents were just annoyed because, you know, they were saying, this is going to cost us more money. Or our house prices are going to go down. So having this like emergency road through us, and we're having to pay more money to put this on the secondary site of where the fire truck should be. So he's leading the petition, you know, he's that kind of person who gets involved in like leading the petition. And I was there, you know, I heard the whole thing, and he's like, "Your Honorable Judge Wasserman," and all this stuff, like, "This is the wrong thing to do. I will take this straight to the top." Like, you know, wow. Like, you know, and he's all about like, you know, and then he literally has said to the judge, like, "I grew up in apartheid in South Africa," you know, and it's like this thing where he's like, "I've been through some shit, like, so don't mess." And like, he doesn't like to talk about it, you know, because I think there was a lot of bad things that happened. And but I've spoken to other relatives of mine who, you know, my grandfather's youngest brother is about 4 years older than my dad. So his uncle, and I spoke to him, you know, and he's like, "You don't know what it was like, man. Like, we were kind of not embraced by anyone. We weren't embraced by, certainly the whites. Then you had the blacks, the colored people, Portuguese, and they just sectioned everyone out. And then you just had Indians, and it was like, well, what are we going to do with these people? We'll just put them in this place here. And, you know, and then the Jews were there and stuff. And my grandfather used to say, you know, we used to stand on street corners as kids, and if we wanted to make money, we'd go and, you know, break into warehouses and steal the metal from the roof tiles, and then melt that down in matchboxes, and then take that and sell it to like the Jewish guy up the road who wouldn't ask you where you got the metal from, you know, and do things like that. And we kind of hustled on in that sense when we were younger. So yeah, I do see a lot of that in answer to your question, in my dad's kind of behavior. And he's an American, he's an American, actually lives in America for most of his life. And people are from everywhere there, and he will be loud and brash and stand up for everything. And so sometimes it's completely embarrassing, you know, like he doesn't get the right service in a restaurant. And whilst like as a Brit kind of, we would say, "Oh no, it's okay," or like, we won't give them a tip or whatever it is, or we won't pay extra. He'll be like, "I want to see the manager. Where is the manager right now? I expect this kind of thing here," you know.
You touched on something really interesting, not just in what you just said, but before. And going back to that comedian, Loiso Gola.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which we talked about previously. But one of the skits he does, and it really made me think about something, but he talks about how, especially in the UK, racism is so subtle, right? Whereas he's like, I grew up in South Africa. Racism was like directly in your face. And obviously he's joking about it, and there were harsh times, but he's almost saying like, you know, they were openly, directly racist. You know, it would be like, blacks cannot go here, right? And so, yeah, I'd love to know your opinion. Do you think there's something in the idea of growing up in that environment where it was so direct and apparent has made these people direct in their approach for other things? Like you said, you know, your dad will stand up for these little things and be harsh. Like, it's kind of black and white. Like, I'm not happy with this service, so I'm going to make it known I'm not happy with it. And it's kind of being in that environment where things are directly in your face, like racism and harshness, that they grow up in that kind of way and not in this more subtle way that I guess we are like in England.
Yeah, I think he's that, because you've got to remember, he grew up in apartheid, and then he kind of came of age and like became a young man in that age, right? So he's seen not only direct forms of racism and how to kind of combat them or whatever, he's also seen, like, you know, Mandela walk out of prison and then go, I'm not going to be angry, and I'm just going to become leader of this country, you know? And like, you know, it's got its problems still, like in some ways, you know, if we view it in a Western perspective, but he's also seen what you can do if you stand up for yourself, essentially. And it's a hard one, you know, like, because even now, you know, the whites who are there will say, my farm was taken away because the blacks came back into power, kind of thing. And then look at what's happening now, you know, like in America, and, you know, the trials on for this horrible police officer who killed someone, you know, and people speaking out. And you kind of think the majority of people would speak out from a human point of view if you treated people a certain way. But, you know, our parents' generations, they had to go through all of that stuff, you know. Like, my brother and I, we joke around about that Jay-Z quote where he says, Hove did that, so hopefully you don't have to go through that. Yeah. And in a way, you know, like, we joke about it because it's like, all right, Hove, like, relax. But, like, a lot of people did that, you know. A lot of people had to go through those things. And people should have those freedoms, you know. And we forget, you know, so many countries, people don't. But, yeah, I definitely see that from my dad. A kind of very loud, charismatic, brash, sometimes very like cunning and clever person, very warm, very generous person. So that's kind of how my dad had been. And I think that's also part of it, is like that side of his family are very warm and generous people, because they remember when they didn't have, you know, everything. Mm. They weren't able to like walk two streets down, you know, because they would get beaten up or worse. So they really appreciate life in that sense.
You named a number of traits. Like, which of these do you think has really rubbed off on you, or the ones that you've really picked up?
My brother and I, and certainly my sister, that we have this kind of concept of like a South African hospitality. And it's the thing that we were taught, right? Where it's like someone comes around your house. I saw it quite differently. Some of my friends growing up, you'd go around their house and you'd be like, I'm hungry. You know, it's after school. It's like 5 o'clock. And they'd be like, yeah, all right. That's your problem. You know what I mean? Like, but then you go to like our house, like my friends would come there and, you know, my mom would be cooking and she'd be like, here, you want some food? Like, and that's the kind of South African hospitality. And I've got family members and stuff. And it's like, you go around and they're like, they don't care if you're hungry or not. They'll just put a whole plate in front of you. And they're like, here's a drink. They don't even say anything. They just hand you a drink. Yeah. You're like, I just popped around to like pick up my football boots or whatever it was. Or and they're like, no, you know, you're having to eat 3 courses. You're staying here the whole evening. We're going to have a good time. You know, they're very generous and welcoming. I think that's the kind of part that we've taken the most. And like, his just appreciation of stuff.
That point around the hospitality, it's definitely a case of like, if you know your friend or even someone who's not even that close a friend, right? Say if it was someone that you played football with who left their boots in your car and they've just come to collect it. You know, my parents or, you know, wouldn't even know who the person is, but they would be embarrassed if this person came round, ended up staying for a bit, and then was to say like, oh, I'm actually quite hungry or I'm thirsty. Like, if they would have to ask, it would be seen as very, very embarrassing for them. And they would be quite disappointed in us to have not offered it.
And you're kind of also taught that at a young age. Your friend comes over and your mum or your dad will say, hey, does your friend want something to eat? Even sometimes it's like, do they like chili things? Like, it's almost like a secret. Like, hey, can they eat spice? And you're like, I don't know. Hey, man, can you eat spice? Oh, yeah, okay, I guess I can, you know. And then they eat curry for the first time. Like, oh, my God, this is amazing, you know. And you're like, dude, like, this is, I grew up having to eat this every day. Like, give me fish and chips. It's like, and it's, that's the beautiful thing about having had like those thing experiences growing up, is because the world's massive and then you get exposed to all of these different cultures and you're like, oh wow, there's different ways to do this. Like, just even look at food, like, it'll bring people together. If you're hungry, you're hungry. Mm. It's funny, like, you go on, you're dating and stuff like that, and people are like, I like drinking, I like food, I like traveling. It's like, yeah, all right, everyone likes stuff. Like, and people forget that, you know.
It's like, I love people who are honest. Oh, really? Because I actually love people who lie. Yeah, it's one of those things.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I love traveling. It's like, cool, man. Like, if you love staying in the same place all the time, like, you wouldn't survive. Like, you know, look at this pandemic, right? I mean, I shouldn't say pandemic. I'm time stamping. I shouldn't be time.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is obviously going to be listened to in 100 or 200 years, and there may be a different pandemic, and then they're going to get really confused of which pandemic you're referring to. Yeah. I mean, in fact, they say what, that they're like, not to be surprised if there's a number of these kind of viruses that spread now.
Yeah, exactly. And Bill Gates been like going on about it for years, and like, and he's trying to alert people, and it's scary, you know, in a lot of ways. But the response has been amazing, like, you know, from lots of countries. Obviously, it's kind of the richer countries are looking out for themselves first. But yeah, I mean, hopefully we can be ingenious and we can use our, we can evolve our way of thinking so we're helping the rest of the planet out, because, you know, ultimately we're ruining it.
True. Before we digress too much into that, tell me, what was the next phase? So, like, how was schooling for you?
So I've kind of skipped over a bit, but essentially, so dad's from South Africa, mum is from Kenya, and they met here. My mum is from a different type of family where they're all like, well, her parents were head teachers and teachers. So she's kind of a nerd. Like, she read every book in the library kind of thing. Like, so she came to London to study her undergrad, and then met my dad at a party. And they tell it in different ways, but essentially my dad says, I saw your mom and she was the hottest girl at the party. So I told my mate I could like drop her home. And then says, this guy came up to me and I needed a lift home or to my old residence. So I was like, yeah, all right, whatever. And then he like persistently came to her, it was her university digs at the time, like every day. So like, I mean, now that kind of behavior is probably complained about, but
hey, that's that resilience of the immigrant hustle, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know how it went down, but I think she had a boyfriend at the time who was delivering flowers to her one day, and he got hold of the guy and like beat him up and took the flowers and then gave her the flowers.
That's amazing.
But he really liked her, obviously, and then they had us, so I'm one of three. I'm the middle child. So I was born in South London. That's kind of where I grew up. I grew up in Tooting and then in Dulwich. And we lived in Dulwich for, about 4 or 5 years. Then my dad got an opportunity to, or made an opportunity to go to California to for his job. My mum and all of us went. And so we moved when I was really young, when I was five, moved to California and then stayed there for years. So I was like in lots of different schools, and eventually went to like a really, really nice Catholic school where, you know, went to church and took communion, even though I wasn't baptized, and learned how to play baseball and American football, and like completely different kind of lifestyle. And and then eventually moved back to London, not too far from where I was born. And then my parents divorced, and my mum raised like us three pretty much by herself.
Wow.
It was quite different. So essentially my parents separated, my mum moved back here, and then there was a big custody battle for about 3 or 4 years. I actually didn't see my dad for about 4 years, and it went to the Court of Appeal. It was an international kidnapping case. So my mum was on the run from Interpol for months.
Damn.
What I remember from it is it was a ruse. We were meant to go to the airport to drop my aunt and my uncle and grandparents on her side, my mum's side, off. And my sister noticed, hey, you know, we've got like more tickets than we should and like loads of luggage. And then we were on a Virgin Atlantic flight to London, you know. And I was in the back of a white van with all the luggage, like driving from the airport.
That's crazy.
It's kind of nuts at the time.
Did you feel you had to assume a bit of the head male role once your mum started raising you guys?
I wish I had that kind of that mentality when I was younger, like as a teenager. I think I have over the years become more of a, like, what I've realized is in families, and this is maybe a cultural thing, is there's always like some sort of, normally a head matriarch. Mm. My grandmother is like the kind of the don, or the kind of head of the family, or whatever it is. And in my mum's family, she's the kind of the equivalent, you know, she like runs things. And I'm trying to be like that to a certain extent, you know, to my generation. But no, when I was younger, I was just a rebellious, angry teenager for most of the time. Because I got separated from my dad and I didn't like the decisions that she made at the time. But looking back, like, she did the decision that she thought was the best. And I was really lucky as well, because she has such a good emotional intelligence and intelligent that she kind of made everything work, even when, you know, I was very difficult with her. But, you know, she came here, she had hardly any money. She had a younger brother who was, you know, in his 20s at the time. And the love I have for that guy is, you know, you're 20 something and your sister turns up, you know, being chased by Interpol with three children, and is like, help me out. And, you know, he was like handling that. And you kind of put yourself in that situation in your 20s, and people are just like, oh, I don't know if I want to go here to university or there.
Yeah.
That dude had to deal with that, you know. So he was kind of like a good role model in that sense of someone who morally did the right thing.
Mm.
And also, like, you know, your heart is with your father as well as your mother. But, you know, my father is like, goes to work one day, and then the next day, the kids are gone. You know, it's like, how do you deal with that? And then you don't see them for 4 years. So that was a lot. And then for me, I just saw her grind like every day. She'd get up at 5. She would get get a bus to another bus, to a train, to the tube, to another bus. And she would go work at Grey Ormond Street Hospital. And she'd come back late, you know, like I think maybe 7 or 8. I think like the term nowadays, they call them like latchkey kids, or free range parenting, as opposed to like helicopter parenting. But she did that and obviously didn't know what it was called. She kind of said, you know, you all have keys to the house, finish school, get home, there's food, and figure it out kind of thing. And so my sister's a year older than me, but when you're 12, when I'm 11, she's big, you know, because girls get bigger at that age. And so, yeah, we used to fight. Over food. We didn't have food. Sometimes we'd have a sandwich. We'd have cheese on toast.
Wow.
You know, like we, you know, it was one woman and three of us. And we'd go to my friends' houses, and some of the nice ones would be like, oh, yeah, can Vic stay for dinner? You know, and, you know, you'd realize, oh, yeah, if I stay for dinner, then I get like this thing called a chicken Kiev, you know, or whatever it is, you know, or my mate's got a PlayStation, you know, I don't have any computer games, or, you know, we couldn't afford them. So I can go around my mate's house, do my homework there with him, and then we can play computer games, and it's all gravy in that sense.
It's amazing though, what you said about your, you know, your mum, you're seeing her every day waking up at 5 and grinding. It's such an impressive thing, but it's also not uncommon, right? So many people, the parents have had to do that, especially when they've come from a place where they don't have any resources, but they have kids, they want to provide for them.
Yeah.
And it, I just think it's not amusing, but, you know, the whole like 5 a.m. club and people being really driven and passionate about waking up at 5. And don't get me wrong, it's a great thing. Like I did it for a while, and it's interesting how it's become this almost superior thing for some people to say, like, I am part of the 5 a.m. club, I wake up really early. Probably in our parents' generation, it was like more of the norm.
Yeah.
It's just they had to do it.
You do it out of necessity. And here it's like, oh, how do you increase your productivity? It's like, well, if you have to get up and like feed three children and educate them, like, and you're a mother, you do it. Like, you know,
yeah.
Unless, you know, there's some exceptions, but you just do it. Like that's the, you know, people, when they have kids, they love to like bang on about how they're like, I'm just going to live for this kid, you know? And you're like, yeah, like, hell yeah. You know, who else is going to do this? And
and
that's where I really respected her for.
The reason I bring that up is not to knock people who do it. Like I said, don't get me wrong. It's a great thing. Yeah. But and I advise people who want to be more productive to wake up early. I think morning is a great time to do stuff. But it is almost the need to appreciate having the luxury to be able to choose to do that rather than, like you say, the case where they had to do that to grind.
Well, I also think sometimes people get it twisted where they're like, let me just do all the things that those successful people do and then I'll become successful. And it's like, that's not how it works, man. Like, they talk about all these people and like Elon Musk didn't get any sleep, or like whatever it was, like Theresa May used to sleep 4 hours a day or whatever, she's prime minister. And it's like, it's because they are so driven to do stuff. They just get up and go and do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, you kind of, I think back now on how I was sometimes when I was a juvenile, I would call my mother in the middle of her hospital shifts and be like, my sister's eating my food. She just threw a knife at me, you know, like she just put her knee into my chest, you know, and like, and I, now you think, what the hell was I doing calling my mother up? She's, you know, she's all the way across London saving sick children, you know, and we're like being petty and like fighting over scraps. But yeah, I mean, but the thing is that she always had, she said this to me, she's like, I was working at a hospital where children from all over the world would come because they were dying, or they had these horrible diseases, or they had these viruses. And like, you guys were all healthy. So it wasn't like, I never felt bad about how you guys had, what you had to do, because, you know, like, I had to interpret for the doctor to tell this couple who couldn't speak English, like, your kid's got like fourth stage cancer all over his body. Like, he's going to die like soon, you know? And like, she would do that. And then she'd come home and we'd be like, I don't have any, you know, where's the cheese? She made all the cheese on toast, you know, or whatever it is. And she was probably just like, what the heck? Do you know how knackered I am? But, you know, so having said that, she wasn't just like coasting. She would, because she was an educated person and her parents were teachers, like the minute she found out I was in like the bottom set for everything in like year 7, she was like, right, I'm locking you in this room. You don't come out of that room. You're not playing with your friends until you finish this exercise and this exercise, you know. And within a year, I go from being like in the bottom set for everything to like being in the top set. And this is like a comprehensive school, like a normal state school. People like drinking and smoking and, you know, not a very nice neighborhood, essentially. And there was friends of mine who I know today, like, grew up, like, they're drug addicts and their lives went a different way, you know. And my mum was like, no son of mine is going to be an idiot, basically. You're going to get an education. You know, Asian kids, that typical mentality, like, you know, if you know nothing, you'll know maths, you'll know English, you'll know science, and you'll get, and 97% isn't good enough. Why didn't you get 100? Like, you know,
yeah.
I'll hit you with a wooden spoon, or back to me, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I guess it was the best thing for us in a lot of ways. Who knows what we would have been doing had we not had that kind of discipline.
Yeah, I mean, discipline at the time never seems, it always seems unjust. Maybe not always, but it really does take you to see the kind of fruits of the punishment, let's say, to kind of see, like, all right, I know what this has done for me.
Yeah, and also it wasn't something that was alien, like the ways we were punished weren't alien in the rest of the family. So, like, sometimes you speak to your friends and they'd be like, I got time out. And you'd be like, what the hell's time out? Like, I got hit in the back
sounds
of the
great.
Slipper. Yeah, I got, like, a rolling pin, like, smacked across me. You know, like, my dad used to get a belt out when I was a kid and, like, lie me on his bed and just, like, whip me with a belt pretty rough. Not whip me, but, like, spank me, you know. And, like, and I fought that dude. Like, he's completely, you know, put me in headlocks and told me, don't ever swear at me. I mean, my mother, when we were in California, my mother, I swore at her. I didn't know what I was saying. You know, I called her a bitch. And she said, what did you say? You know, and she got a teaspoon of chili powder, put it in my mouth, put tape on me, locked me in the toilet and turned the faucet off. And I was there, like, trying to get this chili powder out of my face, you know, like, pulling the toilet cistern up. And trying to, like, wash the stuff out of my face, you know?
That is so innovative. I feel like, I don't know if that is to do with their upbringing and, like, creativity was slightly different then. But, you know, even when I spoke to my dad about his upbringing, they were, yeah, you know, schools and teachers were allowed to do so much more because they were seen as authority. And I imagine that some of these yeah. things went down. Like, our parents obviously got these skill sets of punishment from somewhere. And I feel like it's something that... They're not malicious, right? They're out like, we went through this. We got disciplined this way. This is how we know to discipline you. And, you know, yeah, if you're going to swear at me, and that's a huge respect thing. You know, you don't swear at anyone, but you especially don't swear at, like, your close family. And so to do something like that, it's like, all right, I'm going to punish you. You have to learn. You can't get away with that.
Yeah, it's severe. And it was a severe punishment. And, like, she's a chemist. So she's like, all right, I know this will hurt this kid. And, like, now I love chili. And I rarely swear at them, my family. I still do. And when you do, it kind of means a lot because you're like, right, this is something serious, you know. But yeah, it's interesting to have seen the types of punishment within my family. Like, and you speak to other people and you go, oh, this is used to happen when I was younger. And they're like, oh, wow, yeah, I used to do that. You know, my first friend in primary school here, was like an Ethiopian kid called Mel, and we both played basketball, and I went around his house, and if he said something or his older brother said something, man, his mom would just give him what for, you know. And you'd be like, okay, I ain't the only people getting disciplined for saying stupid shit. And it made you, like, aware of people who are older than you. You just have to sort of show them some sort of respect. You know,
do you think that brought, this is something that I find really interesting, because you're both essentially from immigrant backgrounds, do you think that kind of brought you guys together in that you shared this common understanding of each other's upbringing?
Yeah, I mean, when I first met him, it was like, I was this little American, hey, let's go play football, and all right, mate, like, go and goal. And you're like, oh my God, I thought we were playing football, you know. Flag football. We used to play flag football when I was a kid in the States. And these kids are like, no, it's soccer, mate. Like, it's, you know, like, we call it, it's football here. It's not soccer or whatever it is. And then I was in goal and I was like, I'm in bloody goal again. Like, this is crap. You know, no one wants to be in goal when you're a kid. You just get the ball booted at you as fast as possible. And then there was a few kids who played, who like Michael Jordan and played basketball. Mel was one of them. And he was like, oh, you're from America? Oh, yeah, my dad's got my second cousin or whatever lived there. And he was into like rap and all this other stuff. And so, yeah, you become friends and then you go around his house and then you go, oh, wow, like they have a fruit bowl. And the fruit in the bowl is the same as the fruit in my mum's bowl, you know, like where, because they're Africans, they have like all of the exotic fruits, like pineapples, bananas, like whatever it is, oranges all the time.
Yeah.
And I remember it was weird, like you kind of, at the time, I'd go around my friend, my English, like white friend, Graham's house, and he'd have plums. And I was like, what's a plum? You know, like, I'd never seen a plum before because mum never ate plums. But yeah, there's all these similarities and you do have an understanding with the different children. And you understand kind of in different ways. Like, and it's not just like along ethnic lines or whatever you want to call it, because some of my best friends are like, one of my friends who we bonded over... When I went to university, I went to university in the middle of the country where I didn't know anyone, like zero people. But my goal was always get as far away from home as possible. I'm not going to any of the London universities. And I went and they had a basketball coach there. And he was like this ex-Atlanta Hawks assistant coach. And he'd like knocked up some woman from the town there. And he was the coach of the university basketball team. And he was like... Right, tryouts are today. And I was like, wow, basketball tryouts, amazing. And I turned up and they play you one-on-one on height versus other people. And this scraggly ass white kid with long hair, who was my height, I had to play one-on-one against. And it was first to three, and I just knocked down three shots in his face. And I got put on one side of the gym and he got put on the other side of the gym. And then an hour later, he came back up to our side of the gym. And that was a vetting process for the coach. He was like, let's see if these kids can go one-on-one. So I'm sitting, I've gone to my first lecture, my first ever lecture. And I don't know anyone. And people know people. People went to similar schools or whatever. And I'm like in Timberland boots, like a Tommy Hilfiger jacket. I've got like long, like blonde highlights in my hair, like a piercings, you know, eyebrow rings, all this stuff.
The image I have of this is hilarious, by the way.
I literally looked like I thought I was in Jagged Edge, basically. I think I was a cross between Jagged Edge and NSYNC. It was ridiculous.
What I'm going to do in the show notes for this episode is also try and find a link to... you said you don't have your social Facebook anymore, do you? I was going to try and find a link to some evidence of this online. I'll still try and see what I can do, so...
I mean, it takes a few days for them to cancel it, apparently. So I don't know if it's still up. But yeah, there are like horrible photos of me on Facebook, probably thinking I look like some sort of beach bum mixed with some sort of rapper. And there's that pre-lecture like jitters, like, who are these people? And you're kind of scoping things out. And I was like, oh, man, I don't know anyone here. Who am I going to sit with? And people are looking at me like, this guy? And then the scrawny white kid came over and he was like, hey, man, you're the guy from Ball. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, I was like, I don't know anyone here, man. And he's like, come sit with me. And like, he's literally one of my best friends.
Wow.
That's what happens. It's like all sorts of weird stuff. Like he came from a single parent background. He's got three children. He's had three brothers. Like his mum and his dad divorced. And he, you know, his dad had to work really hard. Like, and it was the first kid in his generation to even go to university, and like he had a difficult time, right? And you don't know if when you first met if that's the case, but you kind of tend to towards people who are like you, or you find things in common with them, and then that kind of strengthens the bond. But yeah, I mean, you definitely see that in other kids and in other people as you get older. Yeah, I mean, I've kind of gone forward to uni, but even before that, like having gone to difficult schools, and like, you know, one of my best friends, I got into a fight with him because of Mel, messed up his glasses, and my mum made me go and apologize. This is my mum, her moral principles. you go find where that kid lives and you go and apologize to him, you know, and like for, you know, scrapping it with him at school. And turns out he lived like down the road from me.
Do you think that was done more of like, we need to show that we're respectful, or was it like a genuinely like, you need to realize the values of showing respect, if you see what I mean by the difference?
I think she, first of all, like, I got suspended, I did all sorts of crazy stuff in school, and for her to get that phone call, like, I've got Vic here from the principal, like, he just got into a fight with this kid, you know. My mum was absolutely devastated, you know, because she's like, at this point, she's like on the board of school governors, like, she wants to people to be respectable members of society, and she's got this little terror who's just like getting into fights at school and doing all this stuff.
Like, this
and
is so, not the kid I raised.
Yeah, this is not how you behave. Like, and no. By the way, if you do behave like that, you go and apologize to someone. Right? Like, so I'm just like, so I rock up at this guy's house and I'm like, I say hi, and his dad, Ian, he kind of laughed at me. He was like, this is the kid that beat you up? And he kind of said, come in, you know? And I was like, what? Like, this is weird. And it's crazy because, you know, you kind of think, well, I'm going to apologize. I just fought this kid. And now, like, we're like good mates and we still hang out. And that's how you meet people. And it is important. It is important to go and apologize. And it was important for him to say, and his parents to say, like, we accept your apology. These things happen. You know, you're just kids. Because they were a certain way. I mean, some parents would have been like, yeah, you know, I'm going to hit you because... You know, and my mum was like, you just go, right? It was like, anything could happen. Yeah, like, all right, fine. So that happened. And I say I've been lucky because I think I was walking a friend of mine home, you know, this is kind of like whatever GCSE time and stuff. And people were drinking and stuff. And this kid was like a bad kid. And I had to walk him to his house. He was drunk. I remember he was a complete nutcase, and on the way he fancied this girl in school and knocked at her house, and I couldn't hold him back. And her dad was this Bayesian guy from Barbados, and he was like, what are you doing, you know? And he's like, I want to speak to your daughter and stuff. And he was like, get the hell out of here, you know, like, F off, you know. I took him to his house, and on the way back I knocked for the same guy. I remember he had this big, like, Rottweiler dog and stuff. And he said, what are you doing here, you know? And I was like, oh my God, this guy's going to, like, beat me up.
Yeah.
And he goes, I just wanted to apologize to my friend. Like, he was drunk and, like, I couldn't stop him and I'm really sorry about that. And he said, who? And he just kind of stopped and was like, what the heck? And he goes, come in. You know, and he's like, are you scared of dogs? And I was like, no. And I was shitting myself. And I was like, yeah. And I came and I sat down and we had a beer. And he goes, and you know, like, people didn't care that you were a certain age back then, but he was like, tell me about yourself, you know. And I was like, you know, I live up the road, I live with my mom, blah, blah. And he was like, do you have a job? And I was like, no. And he was like, well, I work in this golf range and I'm the manager there. You seem like a decent kid. Your mum's obviously brought you up well enough for me to come and apologize for that. Do you want a job? And I was like, what?
That's amazing.
Like, yeah. And I was like, no, I want an interview, man. You know, because I'd seen my dad go in suits and go for an interview or whatever, a job as a job. So he's like, yeah, all right, you come to the golf range at 11 o'clock on Saturday and you can have an interview. And I went all, you know, dressed up and stuff. And he legitimately just like sat there and asked me those questions and then said, oh, hey, you've got a job. You know, and I was a shop assistant at this golf range, and it was a completely different world for me, you know, where I was like, oh, I've got a bit of money in my pocket now. These guys come in, you know, these old guys, and I think the last things they can do before they die are like swim and play golf. And so they'll spend like £600 on a driver and like thousands of pounds on a set of irons. And I get to like sell them this stuff and I got like a little commission and stuff. And I've never really played golf. And all of my African family, like, they all play golf. So it was great. I learned how to play golf. I had my first job when I was a teenager.
So what I love about that is it really seems like what he valued in you was your character. And so it didn't matter kind of the other skill set you had, you know, whether you had good abilities to interact with the type of customer that comes into the golf range, or whether you could sell, or, you know, whether you could count, whatever it may be, right? He just saw that here's a kid whose strength of character and values I already resonate with. Anything else I can teach him on the golf range, I already know that this is someone that I would want working for me and serving. And, you know, like you say, these the type of customers there are spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
So he's putting a lot of trust in you to be able to interact with these people.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm not saying it's something to do with his background and his backstory of going through his own journey.
It is, though.
Yeah.
It is because what the thing about Tony was, I only found this later on, Tony was a doorstep baby.
Oh, wow.
Tony had been left like as an unwanted child because he was, you know, mixed or whatever. And he'd been left on someone's doorstep. So I think that's what happens. People see a little bit of themselves in you, right? I know what it was like to be this kid, you know. And he was like, yeah, you can have a job. And you're completely right. Like he at first he was like, all right, you ain't serving customers. You're doing the stock room. You're behind the scenes. You're replacing people's shoes. And after like a summer or two, then he was like, all right, this kid's got some chat. Like this kid knows, you know, he could pick up a golf club in the shop and be like, tell me about this. I'd be like, this is what the retail price is. This is what the cost price is. This is what the profit margin is. Like, and all you have to do to like old guys who like to play golf is just be nice and be like, how are you, sir? Like, just remember them. And I'll tell you some funny stories. Like in that golf range, I met Ian Wright and I met Ronnie Corbett. And people used to say, Ian Wright comes in here. And I was like, whatever. And everyone who worked there, most of the guys, they would just play practical jokes on each other, like rip the piss out. You couldn't trust anyone in a lot of ways. And they, Ian Wright comes in. I was like, yeah, whatever. Ian Wright doesn't come in here. They know I'm an Arsenal fan. They're just going to sell me that. The striker I watched growing up, just banging goals in before Thierry Henry came along, used to come there. And then one day, you kind of see in the parking lot, someone's like rolled up on like dubs with like a nice, like massive silver Mercedes. And then Ian Wright pops out with his shiny tooth. And you're like, oh my God, Ian Wright's in the store. You know, and I'm like, that's Ian Wright. You know, and you have to be professional and you're containing yourself. And I've got like a name tag on that says Vic and all stuff. And he goes, excuse me. And I'm like, Ian Wright. And he was like, yeah, I'm Ian Wright. Hello. And he comes and shakes my hand. He's a super nice guy. And he goes, I want some shoes. I want some golf shoes. And I was like, I'm selling Ian Wright golf shoes, son. Yes. You know, and he goes for high techs. And I'm like, oh man, I ain't going to make no commission on high techs. This guy's got a lot of money. Plus those high techs are uncomfortable as hell. So I was like, look, I'll get you them. What's your size? And let me get you two other shoes to try alongside, kind of thing. You know, this was almost my sales technique. But there was this other shoe. It was the most expensive shoe we had. It was like 240 quid, but it was the most comfortable shoe by all accounts. Like I tried them on and they were like, if I was ever buying golf shoes, those are the ones I'm buying if I ever had the money. And so I brought them out and I didn't say anything. And he goes, I actually like these. And I was like, sweet, you know? And he's like, I'll take two. Have you got them in different colors? And he was the nicest guy. Every time he used to come in, probably a different car. And he would remember everyone's name. Like he'd be like, all right, Vic, how you doing? You know, and you're just like, wow, like that guy, that's the guy's a footballer. And I learned that, like, that's what I learned, how to talk to people, how to talk to men, how to talk to like older men. And that's been so useful in like my own personal career when you're speaking to adults and stuff. But the Ronnie Corbett story was completely different because Ronnie Corbett was in the shop and I was like, that's Ronnie Corbett. Like, he can't just be queuing up. So I go up to him and I'm like, hello, sir. Can I help you? And he's like, oh yes, you know, hello, like I'm here to collect a putter, you know. And he's had this putter cut down from like whatever height it for him is. So I go in the back in the storeroom where we do club repairs and adjustments, and I pulled his putter and I put it down the back of my, I clip it onto the back of my belt, and I get the tallest putter I can find, and I in the middle of the store in front of everyone, because we were playing practical jokes, like go, here you go, here's your putter, sir, and then plonk it down right next to Ronnie Corbett, and it's taller than him. I'm like laughing, like everyone's like having, like smiling, and he just goes nuts, turns red, Did you? That's not my part. And oh my god! This comedian can't take a joke. And I gave him his part, and he storms out. And as soon as he storms out, everyone just starts like clapping and laughing. It was hilarious. And then I got the hairdryer treatment from my manager. You know, people come in here to see him. Like, yeah, I could do that to our customers. And you're like, oh, and then you live and you learn, man. Like,
yeah, if anything, it should have showed some character.
Yeah, I mean, come on, it's a comedian. But that's the type of stuff that my dad's side of the family would do. Like, let's have a laugh. Life's too short.
There's some good stories there. There's definitely some good stories.
So that was my first job, because I say I've got lucky with kind of people, other people from immigrant backgrounds kind of helping me. Probably one of the biggest helps I got was my friend's dad. I used to get kicked out of my house a lot by my mum. And I used to go to my friend's house. And sometimes I would like sleep outside in his garden because they had like one of those big swinging chairs. And the whole family were pretty nice people. And at A-levels, we had to go to a different school. And I was just going to go to like the crappy comprehensive, not crappy, but in relative school tables, certainly crappy, down the road. And as soon as he found out, he's like, why are you going there? Why are you not going where my son's going? You know, and I was like, well, where your son's going is like £4,000 a year. And like, I don't have £4,000. Like, I've been working, but I don't have £8,000 anyway. And he's like, how much money do you have? And I said, well, I've got a few thousand pounds, but I don't have enough. And he just goes, and he's a Patel from like Uganda, you know. And was like, what? And I think part of him was like, I want my son to go to the same school as him, because they kind of tacitly compete and bring each other up in terms of grades and stuff. And he's like, I'll give you the money.
Wow.
He just kind of, you know, I went home and said to my mum, I said like, yeah, for A-level, I could go here. And he's willing to give me the money in cash, right? And my mum just started crying. And she was like, it's your decision. You know, they obviously like you and they want you to go, and like, they're trying to do something nice for you. So it's up to you, man. And I went, and I realized it was a completely different type of school. Well, years later, I went to him and I said, here's the money with interest. And he said, I don't want it. You know, he like ripped the check up in front of me and was like, at some point just made me a promise. And I was like, yeah, anything, dude. Like, if you come across someone who needs help, like, you should help you. I want you to help them. I was like, of course, man, you know, like, and because he didn't need the money, it wasn't a big deal for him, but it was such a generous thing he did. And I went to this like fee paying school, and I realized this school is completely different. Like, how I'd been taught before is you understand the subject, the quality, and everything like that, and you try to like come up with the answers in tests. And this fee paying school was like, we had tests every week.
Yeah.
And by the time you came to the end of the year, I just breezed through all the exams. Like, I think I got the highest marks in most of my classes and stuff. And it was such a different way of doing things. And in my head, I was like, is this what these fee paying schools do? Is they just like spoon feed all the children so they just pass exams? Like, this is, on the one hand, I was really grateful I got high grades. On the other hand, I was like, this is a completely different way of learning. Like,
yeah,
this makes sense in that sense. Like, well, ironically, you know, you talk about like the set coming from like your parents being immigrants and like experiencing things like people being prejudiced to you because you don't look the same, or like people being racist and stuff. And in that school, there was this like subculture, these subgroups of like people who were carrying so this is a bad side of it, they carry their parents or their grandparents' prejudices with them.
Wow. Yeah.
And you'd be like, well, hold on, like, but you're 12, like, yeah, you didn't fight in the war against Nazis, like, maybe your grandparents did and that's what you hear at home. But these kids in that fee paying school, they were in all these like weird little gangs, and I was never in a gang. Like, I didn't care about, you know, like, I had Indian friends, but I had like white friends, black friends, like Chinese friends, Thai friends, like played basketball and all this other stuff.
Was it more elitist? Like, they kind of saw themselves as superior or better, or was it just the case that, you know, it was, you guys are different?
So half of them were elitist, and like, you know, like the guy whose father owned like Lufthansa Airlines or something, he went there. And like he drove in a Porsche or a BM or whatever it was, like an M5 every day. And you're like, who's that Russian kid? You know, and it, like he just had loads of money and stuff. So they were a bit elitist in that sense. But these are like kids who like, because I always thought if I ever got like into a fight, it would be like some sort of racial thing. It'd be like skinhead white dudes. But like these kids were, oh, we're Tamil Tigers. And I'm like, what? Like, and then some people are like, oh, we're Pakistanis, or like, we're like Gujarati, we're Jaffna Tamils, like we're like, you know, Punjabis and stuff. And you'd be like, what? Like these brown people are weird. Like they think, and it's like, so you're fighting a war with the Sinhalese, like in Croydon or wherever you're from. Like, it doesn't make sense. Like,
is it thought? And I'm wondering, do you think some of that was just a feeling of wanting to belong to something rather than even, you know, necessarily being a pride for your own nation? It was just this idea that you have an identity and you belong in, yeah, you know, some kind of sect or group in a school.
Yeah, to completely, like adolescence, that time, what are you, 17, 18, when doing A-levels? You want to belong. People get recruited into the military at that age because you're trying to find out who you are, and the military goes, hey, like, we'll look after you. In the same way, like, horrible terrorist cells are recruiting young people to do their horrible bidding. You know, like, you're impressionable. And those kids, yeah, they wanted to belong. But they also carry this weird stuff where they're just like, oh, yeah, you and me are the same. Because we're, like, both, like, Tamil. It's like, but you speak English, man. Like, you're from, like, South London. It doesn't make sense. Like, and I remember getting into fights because I was protecting one of my friends. And I used to play basketball with these kids from, like, Croydon College, which is, like, a relatively rough college back then, in the park. And these kids from these stupid little gangs they thought they were in, you know, would like turn up and be like, where's this guy, you know? And all of my Croydon college mates, we all stopped playing basketball. And I was like, all right, like, if you want to fight, let's fight. And they'll, you know, and we, and that, and it escalates into this thing. And you kind of think, is that your, that's your identity? You could identify with everything. And from my point of view, it was completely crazy because I'd lived here, I'd lived in America. When I went to Catholic school in America, it was like Filipinos, Mexicans, like white American, Irish people, like all sorts of Catholic people, right? I never really saw like a subsect of Indians within, or like Tamils and all these people, and identified as like, because it's like, you're brown, like your kid's my age. We're not that, you know? And it's like, okay, all right, man, like, that's cool. Yeah, it was an interesting place to be. And I worked really hard because I had this kind of like, my friend's dad just gave me money. Like, I can't fail, you know, I got 290 out of 300 in like my top subject. Like, I wasn't going to fail, because it was like someone was being nice and they gave it to me. There was kind of that pressure in the back of my mind.
That's an amazing mindset, actually. Yeah. And not necessarily saying it's a unique mindset, but it is a really good way of viewing the fact that you weren't even just owing this to yourself, but you're owing this to the fact that someone who trusted you to do well. It would be such a kick in the teeth if you didn't live up to it. And, you know, almost insulting to throw it back in his face.
And also, it was so generous because at the time, like I don't want to talk too ill of like my father. He's a great person in loads of ways. But because he wasn't around, it was like, here I've got this other type of like father figure who's looking out for me in the way that I would expect my dad to have done had he been able to do that. Or, you know, I don't even know if he knew about it, but someone who's going like, and I don't know, I can't ask you his reasoning. Unfortunately, he passed away. But he saw something which either helped him and helped his son, or he loved his son so much. He was like, this is my son's friend. I want them to go to the same school together.
Amazing.
And since then, like, I've made good on my promise, like a bunch, you know, like I've come across people who needed help. Like I've done stuff in schools where I've helped kids. Like, I've given like thousands of pounds of like advice for free to people to help them out of jams and like save them money in the long run, all this other stuff, because it's really important to do that to people and to give those kind of opportunities to people.
What's going on, guys? Anand here. Thanks for listening to part one, where we got to dive into Vic's upbringing and his appreciation for the role that both of his parents played in the values that he learned from them, along with some great stories of, well, getting into fights and making fun of Ronnie Corbett's height, but also being a really thoughtful and loyal friend. If you did enjoy the conversation, share it with others, and most importantly, make sure you come back next week for part two, where Vic covers the second half of his life, as well as some of his honest and unfiltered thoughts of work, health, and a lot more. You can reach me on Instagram at The Journey Onwards Podcast in the meantime. Otherwise, have a great week, and if you can, make it even better than the last one.